The following presentation is brought to you from the supporters of the Church of the Sovereign God.
Today we're going to continue our teaching on the books of the minor prophets. We've been going through that as a series, and today we're going to be seeing the book of Habakkuk. The name Habakkuk comes from a Hebrew word meaning embrace. That Hebrew word from which the word embrace comes probably comes from a Hebrew root word, in other words, a word where that one comes from, meaning to embrace. And so we could say that the word or the name Habakkuk means embrace or to embrace. And I think that when we look at this book, we also can see that it can also mean embracer. And so as we look at the book of Habakkuk, I think what we can very clearly understand and see is that it can be applied to Habakkuk's true nature. Because he definitely was someone who embraced God and God's way of life. He was an embracer. He certainly was. A little background on the book and a little bit on the man before we get into the book itself. The first thing that we notice is that Habakkuk is never mentioned in any other biblical book. He's one of the few people in the Bible that has a book written by him. His name is the title of the book, never mentioned anywhere else. We also see that we don't know exactly when he lived. However, from looking at the contents of the book, some historical statements that are referenced in the book, he probably lived about, and I'm rounding this off, about 600 B.C., shortly before Nebuchadnezzar began to invade and conquer Jerusalem. The book is not internally dated. The content suggests that it was written during the reign of King Jehoiakim, who reigned from about 608 to 597 B.C., even though he's never mentioned by name, but because of circumstances, we do believe that it is right around in that time. We do know that the northern tribe of Israel had already gone into a captivity, and we also know from reading the book of Habakkuk that the nation of Judah was now about to be punished by God by the Chaldeans or the Babylonians, as we would typically refer to them. We also can determine from the reading of the entire book and putting it all together that the events of the book probably took place between the time of about 605 B.C., and Jerusalem's fall in 586 B.C. So it took place somewhere during that period of time. He probably would have had knowledge, probably would have known about the fall of both Nineveh and the Assyrian Empire, which fell in 612 B.C. We also can see from the book itself that when referring to himself, he uses the term the prophet. He, along with three other men in the Bible, prophets in the Bible, there are only four of them that actually refer to themselves as prophets within their own writings, and Habakkuk is one of them. The other three are Isaiah, Jeremiah, and Haggai. When you look at the book, I think we can easily conclude that without a doubt, he surely was a prophet of things to come, because that's what he does. He prophesied some events that are going to take place yet in the future, short in one sense, but it's yet in the future of it happening when he's writing it down. Because he prophesied at least 20 years prior to the Babylonians capturing and destroying Jerusalem. So it's not a long time before, but it is still a time before. And so that would make it yet in the future. We also can see from the book that a great deal of the lessons that were for that time, for the nation of Judah at that time, they apply to us today. And so the book is certainly something that is meant for us. The nation of Judah should have listened to the prophet. They didn't. They didn't listen. The style of the book is written in what is called poetic style. And the third chapter itself, which is just three chapters, and the last chapter itself, is actually written in the Hebrew as a poem. Now, we don't have it written in our Bible to read like a poem, but it actually is in the Hebrew. It is a poem. Some commentators believe that Habakkuk was more of a writer than what we might call a preacher, you know, someone who's standing up and speaking to the people. And one of the main reasons is because he functions somewhat differently than the other prophets who would have been contemporary with him. For example, Habakkuk asked some very tough questions. And I mean, he directed the questions to God. And the others don't. At least, they don't write it down. He writes his questions down. He asked God some very tough questions, and the others didn't. At least, like I said, they didn't write them down where this one did. So his function in that way is somewhat different. And I know there would be some people who would think that it's wrong to ask God some really challenging and tough questions. I don't think so. When you really look at the book, he asked God these questions. It's probably questions that we have asked somewhat or some way like these questions, and we want to know the answers. And then we might step back and go, oh, I feel really bad that I'm really questioning God in this way. I don't think that was his attitude at all. I mean, when we hear these questions, we may think, whoa, this is dangerous. But God tells him to write these things down. For example, I have three typical type of questions. I'm not saying these are the exact questions that he asked, but it's this kind of thing. One would be, why aren't you, and the you here would be God, why aren't you doing anything about Judah's sinfulness? They're sinning. Why aren't you doing anything about it? That's pretty challenging. That's pretty straightforward. A second one would be, how can you allow Judah to continue in this state? And a third one would be something along the lines of, what are you going to do about it? I've somewhat asked those questions of myself with the nation that we're in now. What are you going to do about the mess that we're getting ourselves into because of the decisions that are being made? That we didn't have any, I didn't have anything to do with some of the decisions that's coming upon us as a people. I didn't have part of the decision. But so I know I've asked God, not so boldly maybe as, so what are you going to do about it? But I looked at the book and I see what I think he's going to do about it. I think we see what he's going to do about it. Because in the book, God answers these questions. And God also explains the consequences. There is a lesson for us here. A lesson from the very beginning that we can see is that God does not always give us the answers we want or what we expect. We as humans, we usually have it in our own mind how we want God to answer our prayers. Then when God answers it in a way that is different than what we would want or what we would expect, a question and a lesson would be involved in the question, how do we respond? How do we respond? As I mentioned, we're going to get into the chapters and we're going to see details and read quite a bit of the book in that sense. But before we do that, I'd like to go through what I call a breakdown by each one of the chapters. There's only three chapters. The first one in chapter one, Habakkuk was very low. We might even want to use the word of depressed because of the sinfulness of his people that's going on all around him. And he knows this is bad. And like I said, he asked God, what are you going to do about the sins of the people? And how can you even allow Judah to continue in this state of sinfulness? And what are you going to do about it? You know, those kind of questions. would make us believe that he was very low, and maybe even somewhat of a depression, because he was feeling hopeless because of the evil that is around him. And God answers him. Then in chapter 2, it shows that he goes up to the watchtower to wait for the second answer. So in chapter 1, he asks some of these real hard questions, and God answers him. And then in chapter 2, he says, "Now I'm going to go up into the watchtower, and I'm going to wait for you to give me another answer to some more questions." He also tells us in chapter 2 that Babylon is going to catch it. Oh yeah, they're going to carry Judah into captivity, but Babylon's going to catch it, and we see this in chapter 2. Then in chapter 3, we see him praising God. Now, we're going to come back to this verse in just a moment, but the very last phrase in the book of Habakkuk is very telling. And the last phrase of the book is, "and makes me walk on my high places." Now, we're going to come back to that phrase, but that's how the book ends. And so he's praising God, and that's how he ends the book. So he starts out really low, really depressed, challenging God in one way. And then at the end of the book, he's turned, I guess you would call it, you know, full, you know, half turn here. He's facing one way. God, why don't you do this? And at the end of the book, he's praising God because what God has told him that he's going to do, and because he knows who God is. Continuing down in somewhat of the breakdown in chapters 2 and 3, Habakkuk makes some, I would call them, declarations. In chapter 2, starting in verse 6, he paints the picture for us of the downfall of Babylon. And in doing that, there are what we might call five burdens, or another word that is often used in the scripture is the word woes. And he declares these five woes upon Babylon. But it doesn't apply just to Babylon. It applies to people or nations that are rebelling against God, but it's directed in the book toward Babylon. One of those woes, number one, would be the plunderer will be plundered. Number two, a house built by evil gain will witness against its owner. Now, these are telling whenever you really stop and think about these things, and you think about it even in our society today, with all the things going on, can any of these woes maybe come back toward us? That's a question. Number three, the capital built by blood will be fuel for the fire. Now, some of these you got to think about, but these are things that are right out of the book. Number four, there are five of them here. Number four is the producer of drunkenness and shame will in turn be put to shame. We'll see some of that as we go through in the book. And then number five, the idolatry of Babylon disappoints the idol maker. I mean, they're so wicked. They're so wicked, and they're into the idols that even the idol makers are disappointed with these people who are idol worshipers to the degree that they are. And don't think about idols as being what we typically think of about being a little statue or a medium size or a huge statue. It's much more than that. We're told, this is still in chapter 2, a broader breakdown of chapter 2, Babylon will be held guilty for their wickedness, but God is going to use them anyway. As wicked as they are, God's still going to use them. There are lessons that we see from that. We'll point those out when we go through. Chapter 3 is, as I said earlier, in the form of a poem, and it is picturing or painting a picture for us is the appearance of God as he is exalting his vengeance and exercising his vengeance in the world and it pictures God as he is saving his people. So let's take a look into the book itself and let's see some points and some lessons from this, I believe, a fascinating minor prophet book, the book of Habakkuk. Habakkuk chapter 1 and verse 1. We're not going to read all the chapter, so I'm not going to do all of this reading, but we're going to read some verses and then make some points. In verse 1, it says, the burden which Habakkuk the prophet did see. Verse 3, why do you show me iniquity and cause me to behold grievance? For spoiling and violence are before me. He's describing what's going on in the nation of Judah. He's describing what his people are involved in. This is what he's doing. He says, why are you showing me these things? Why do I get to know this? Why do I have to know this? Verse 4, the wicked do compass about the righteous, therefore wrong judgment proceeds. Oh, the wicked are surrounding the righteous. He's calling Judah the righteous, even though he's talking about in these same verses how bad this is, that Judah is so wicked, yet there's a company coming up against them that is even more wicked than these people who are the righteous. Now, why would somebody be referring to Judah here as being so wicked and then come right around and talk about him as being the righteous? We'll make a comment on that also a little bit later. We'll see, but I want you to think about it. Then God tells Habakkuk, I am going to deal with this in a way that you will not believe. And he does. Because it's not the way man would work it out. God does things. He answers. Remember I said, he answers our prayers. And sometimes he answers it in a different way than what we wanted it to be. Then how do we respond to it? Well, that's exactly what we see in this book. Because God says, this is what I'm going to deal with. I'm going to give it in a way that you're not going to believe. And it's here that we need to ask ourselves a question. How true is this statement in our own lives? Especially since most people underestimate the power of God. And it would be rare, very rare, if ever, that we would overstate God's abilities to perform. Because you see, what we do is we as people, we tend to lessen in one sense what it is that God can do. And so we ask him, how are you going to deal with this? And then God answers back to Habakkuk and he says, I'm going to deal with this in a way that you're not going to believe. And when he tells him what he's going to do, he goes, whoa, why are you doing this? Do we ever deal this way with God? See, it's a very telling book. It's a very telling book. We have to really think about this. Because God has all kinds of abilities to perform. Contrast. Whether it was having the Babylonian army punish Judah by taking him into a 70-year captivity, or whether it was God raising Jesus Christ from the dead. Two extremes, if you think about this, but God has the ability to perform and to do these things, and God has more power than we can imagine. And that's an incredible lesson that we can learn from this book. Because how he deals with Judah, with his horrible, wicked nation. Chapter 1, verse 5. Behold, you among the heathen, and regard, and wonder marvelously, for I will work a work in your days which you will not believe. This is where he says, I'm going to deal with this in a way you're not going to believe. Though it be told you, for lo, I raise up the Chaldeans, that bitter and hasty nation, or haughty nation. It's translated different ways in different Bible translations, but the King James says hasty nation, which shall march through the breadth of the land to possess the dwelling places that are not theirs. So Habakkuk, I think as any of us would do in some way, we would cry out to God asking for justice to be done among, and as in some other verses, I'm just putting some words here from some of the other verses to make the point here, that we would cry out for justice against them that deal treacherously and against them who devour the man that is more righteous. Verse 14, that make men as fishes of the seas. Is this what Babylon was doing to Judah? Absolutely. This is exactly what was happening to them. And then in verse 15, catching them in their nets. And then in verse 16, it says, they sacrifice unto their net. What we're seeing here in these verses here, 13, 14, 15, 16, right down through there, what we're seeing is that sinful men worship the evil devices that got them their power. Whether it be money, whether it be military, whatever it is, it's through this word net. It says, and they capture, you know, men of the sea, catching them in their net. That's their evil devices. That's what that's referenced to. This is an analogy that he's using. So it's broader than what we think. We read and go, oh, he's talking about fishing. He's not talking about fishing. We find a very interesting thing about the man Habakkuk is simultaneously at the same time he is mourning over Judah's sin and over the fact that their enemies will overpower them. He's doing these at the same time, and we see this in these verses here. We also have to remember that God will eventually judge the enemies of his people, and God is going to save his own. But it doesn't look like it when the enemy is coming in as a flood and the people are being, you know, prophesied to be carried away into a captivity. It doesn't look like that. But that's what we got to remember, and this is why these books are written like this, for us to see this, to know this, to understand that this is how God does. And this point is a point of a promise to us. So this is a very awesome thing to think about. Chapter 1 and verse 12, the B part of the verse says, O Lord, you have ordered them for judgment, and O mighty God, you have established them for correction. In other words, you put these people out here to correct us, but we also know at the same time that you've ordered judgment for them. And so this is what Habakkuk is, as I said, simultaneously doing, mourning on one side and praising God on the other, because he knows he's going to save the people. We move on to chapter 2, and here it says in verse 1 that he's looking for answers. Verse 1, it says, I will stand upon my watch and set me upon the tower and will watch to see what he, God, will say unto me and what I shall answer when I am reproved, when I'm corrected. How am I going to answer whenever he answers me and I'm corrected? How am I going to respond? He said, I'm going to wait and see. I'm going to go up there and see. Here in chapter 2, God does answer. He does answer Habakkuk by assuring him that God is going to punish the Babylonians also. And this is what he tells us in this chapter. Basically, God's answer was, don't worry about the Babylonians. They're going to get theirs too. Is Judah going to catch it? Yeah, Judah's going to catch it. They're going to catch it by the Babylonians. But don't worry, because the Babylonians are going to get theirs too. This is kind of what he's answering to him here. So God then instructs Habakkuk to write it down. And this is an important point, and we tend to miss this point. Because what is about to happen is so certain that God tells Habakkuk that he should go ahead and record it. And he said, even though in verse 3 that it may seem to tarry or to wait or be prolonged, don't worry about it because it's going to happen. It's going to happen. When justice seems to be tarrying or seems to be still remaining and nothing being done about it, we usually have the feeling that it's never going to come. However, God promises that it will come. Now, that's a powerful lesson from this book, because here's the point. We either believe it or we don't. We either act on the belief or we act on the not believing it. And that's what we see from this book. This is what we see here, and this is awesome. Because, brethren, what it comes down to, it is faith in God that makes us believe there is, to use the phrase, light at the end of the tunnel. And it is this light at the end of the tunnel that kind of keeps us going, even though it hasn't happened yet. We know it's going to because we have faith and trust in God that it's going to happen, even though it hasn't happened yet. But we know it's going to happen because God said so. God then gives Habakkuk words that are recorded for us here in two different verses. In verse 4 and the B part of the verse, it's chapter 2, verse 4, the B part, it says, "The righteous will live by faith." And that word in some translations is, "The righteous will live by faithfulness." And are they two separate words? Well, yes and no. Faith is this hope, you know, this knowing that something is going to happen, but it hasn't happened yet, but we trust in God. And faithfulness is a little bit more of an active word because it means we're going to continue moving on and we're going to continue living and doing God's way of life because we have faith. So, yes, faith and faithfulness, they're a little bit different, but that's what it's going to be. And so when some use the word faith, the righteous will live by faith, and some say the righteous will live by faithfulness, they're both correct. One is meaning, and they're going to continue on in that way. They don't just have this belief. They have this belief and this knowing, and therefore they can continue going in that direction. And so I actually like the word faithfulness even somewhat better, even though the word faith is a good one. And the other passage that God gives to Habakkuk to comfort him is chapter 2, verse 20 in the A part of the verse, where he says, "God will still reign in his holy temple." The faith are going to, you know, the faith of the righteous, they're going to live by that. They're going to continue living that way of life. And God is going to reign in his holy temple. And then we see here an interesting point of instruction that I think that we can benefit from reading this and seeing this. He was told to write down what he was seeing in this vision. Here is a lesson for us that we don't even tend to pay much attention to this, and I think we need to do this. When God shows us something, write it down. Oh, God gave me this insight the other day, and I thought it was really interesting, and we go on, and that's it. No, it's real plain. God says, tells him, he says, write it down. I'm giving this to you. Write it down. I'm giving you some insights. Write it down. So the lesson to us is, when God gives us something, some information, some understanding, write it down. Write it down. I mean, after all, if God is involved in whatever it is that is happening, it will come to pass. Habakkuk 2 and verse 2, "And the Lord answered me and said, write the vision and make it plain upon tablets, that he may run that reads it. For the vision is yet for an appointed time, but at the end." In other words, it's not yet happening, but it's going to be an appointed time. On down, a little bit further. Remember I told you what he's writing here, it took place probably about 20 years, you know, before they actually went into the captivity. And so this is what he's telling him here. And then it goes on and it says, "It shall speak and not lie. Though it tarry, wait for it, because it will surely come. It will not tarry." However long that we may think, oh, this is too long, this is too long. No, it's not. Because this is on God's timetable. We're the one that's impatient. God's the one that's in charge. We either believe God or we don't. and we believe it. It's just sometimes we give up. And this is what we're to be learning from here. Don't. The sense of, I've told you before that in the Hebrew, they have the words, and you could look at how the word is used, and you could look up how the word might be even, the literal word means. In the Hebrew, there is what is called the sense of the word. You know, what it is getting across. The sense of this teaching is, write it on a billboard large enough so that if a man rides by on a horse, seeing the sign, he can read the words. Only we don't even write it down when God gives us information. And he says, write it down so big that if a man riding by on a horse can see it, he can read it as he's riding by. He can see it and he can read it as he's going by because he will know what God is saying because it's large enough and it's clear enough. Tell others. When God gives us insights, I use the word sometimes, downloads. When he gives us these things, and I think that he's giving all of us, hopefully in some way, some insights and some downloads. When he does, write them down and share it with others. This is a lesson that we're getting here. The next thing we see, we're still here in chapter 2, the next thing that we see is we see what I would refer to as a prophetic curse on Babylon for their, and he uses the one word, for their drunkenness. It's much bigger than just being drunkards, drinking too much. That's like the symbol that they put it all under in this chapter. And it comes as a very sharp rebuke against the Babylonians. And it is a sharp rebuke from God toward Haggai to write it down so that the Babylonians would have it. And it is a rebuke of the people of Babylon for their drunkenness, their pride, their covetousness, their violence, and their corruption. It's much bigger than just drinking too much. The Babylonian people by this time as a nation, as an empire, they had overpowering desires and they wanted more and more and more things, stuff, and more people to bring underneath them and to be in charge of them. They had degenerated into a, what I would call a very despicable and disgraceful people. Does this sound like anything that we might see in any nation that we might know of? And of course, by their doing that, they would be inviting God's judgment upon themselves for this type of living. And God's going to use them anyway. And what we need to realize is, this is a warning to us. I don't like the way they do this. I don't like this, and I don't like this other thing. Okay, what are we doing about it? Habakkuk chapter 2, verse 15. Woe unto him that gives his neighbor drink, that puts your bottle to him, and makes him drunken also, that you may look on their nakedness. In other words, you're exposing everything about him is what he's talking about. You are filled with shame for glory. Drink you also, and let their foreskin be uncovered. The cup of the Lord's right hand shall be turned unto you, and shameful spewing shall be on their glory. This is describing what's going to happen to this mighty Babylonian empire, the most powerful nation on the face of the earth. And their drunkenness, their covetousness, their violence, their all of these horrible things, their pride, their arrogance, and all of this stuff is going to spew out, and it's going to spew out onto whatever kind of glory they may have. When you throw up on something that was really pretty and shiny before, what does that look like? Not too good. And this is what is being described. You see, the Babylonian Empire was never satisfied or content with the size of their empire. They kept trying to conquer more and more. But you know what we also need to realize is, this could be considered as dual as it could also be describing Judah. Or us. Habakkuk then gives a series of woes to describe how bad Babylon really is. When you look at these woes, we need to consider them because they need to be taken as a worldwide description of all, not just the Babylonians, but any nation, any people that would live like this that's being described, these woes are there. Woe to the proud. This is all in chapter 2, so I'm going to just give you the verses. I'm not going to read them, but I just give you the verses. One is, woe to the proud, verses 4 and 5. Woe to the covenant, verses 5 through 8. Woe to the deceitful, 9 through 11. Woe to the violent, 12 through 14. Woe to the sensual or the carnal or the earthly, verses 15 through 17. And the last one, woe to the idolater, verses 18 through 20. Now, if you just take those verses along with each one of those woes and read those verses, you will see that it's there. I mean, it's just here. And there are lessons and there are points and there are warnings for even us today. Because, brethren, what we need to realize and think about is that only a relationship with God can be truly satisfying. And here's the sad point. Neither Judah nor Babylon ever got this point. And a question that serves us a point and a warning for us is, how about us? Do we get it? Do we get this point? And brother, here's an important concept for us to consider. The proud person puts himself first, and then he goes out and he uses and abuses others. In contrast to that, the righteous person has humility, and he will put others before self, and he will do things for the good of others, i.e., Jesus Christ. So I have a question for us to consider. How concerned are we, the Church of God, about the problems we see in our society or in the world at large? Well, I don't have anything to do with that. Let's see. The proud person puts himself first, and the haughty, and the contrast of that is the righteous person has humility and put others before self. And he thinks about others, what is best for the others. Where are we? I know it's a tough question, you know, but it's a question I think that we have to consider. Where are we? And as you continue reading in this book, it becomes very obvious that Habakkuk cared more about stating and declaring God's holiness than defending the nation of Judah. Now, he started out, remember, he starts out and he says, what are you doing about this? And why are you doing it in this way? See, he's already kind of shifting in a way he's looking at this. God is God and he's right, and I want to declare that holiness as opposed to defend Judah in this. Chapter 1 and verse 13. you are a purer eyes than to behold evil, and cannot look upon iniquity. Wherefore, lookest you upon them that deal treacherously, and holdest your tongue when the wicked devour the man that is more righteous than he? You see, Habakkuk knew God hated evil. And yet at the same time, he was amazed that God was going to use such a sinful nation, more sinful than Judah, because he looked at Judah as being, well, they're righteous as compared to Babylon. And the reason is because, well, they're the people of God. And so we consider one righteous and one not righteous, but in reality, neither one were righteous. But that's the contrast. That's why, how he's seeing it. At the same time, Habakkuk also was realizing that God is more merciful than we are merciful. Therefore, he correctly asked God to revitalize the people, meaning Judah. Chapter 3 and verse 2. And so we go on into chapter 3. Verse 2, O Lord, revive your work in the midst of the years. In the midst of the years, make known in wrath, remember mercy. So here in this chapter, we see Habakkuk meditates on or muses on about how God had delivered Israel out of Egypt. It's amazing how many times that story comes up in the books of the Bible, that there are stories there. I mean, he's teaching us a lesson about what all is going on, and he goes back to there to bring forward something, and it's about the greatness of God. You know? And this is what he's doing. He looked back on those days, and he considered them days of glory, when God brought the children of Israel out of Egypt, and he brought them out through Teman and the Mount Paran, and he remembered, in these verses, you can read all these verses are there, he remembered the pestilence in Pharaoh's courts and how God opened the sea and how he afflicted those who stood in the way of God delivering his people. I mean, we know this is what he's, this is where he's wording this. And so we see this back at 3 and verse 13. You went forth for the salvation of your people, even for salvation with thine anointed. You wouldest the head out of the house of the wicked by discovering the fountain unto the neck. Selah. Think about this. You destroyed the head. What head? Well, yeah, Pharaoh, but he's talking about the head. The mighty army, the mighty nation upon the face of the earth. He destroyed them to deliver his people, because they were in captivity. Why were they in captivity? Because they had lost sight of God. And here God's delivering them out. And it's just like, this is going to happen again. This is going to happen again. And then, in this chapter, Habakkuk says that he trembled because God was about to judge Judah in a very profound way. Verse 16, when I heard, my belly trembled, my lips quivered at the voice. Rottenness entered into my bones, and I trembled in myself, that I might rest in the day of trouble. Huh. Some say he asked God if he would let him die, that I don't have to see this, that I might rest in the day of trouble. When he comes up upon the people, he will invade them with his troops. He's describing Babylon as coming in and taking away the people of God. Yeah, God's going to deal with Babylon, but the people of God are still going to be taken away. And this is what he's talking about. This is what he's seeing, and he trembled as a result about it. Now we read verses 17 and 18. Although the fig tree shall not blossom, he's describing Judah. Neither shall fruit be in the vines. The labor of the olive shall fail. The fields shall yield no meat. The flock shall be cut off from the fold. and there shall be no herd in the stalls. Verse 18. Yet, even though all of this is how bad it is in Judah, what's about to happen, how bad it is, yet I will rejoice in the Lord. I will joy in the God of my salvation. How do we face trials and tests in our lives? I'm not even talking about it's a whole nation about to get taken away and wiped down the tubes, it looks like. And then looking, yeah, but God's going to deliver his people out. Yeah, we know all of this. But how do you deal with trials and tests and problems that are going on in your life on an individual basis? Do you know this book answers it? I mean, it's there. We've actually seen it. We need to look at it a little bit clearer, but it's there. I'm not a minister who recommends, I mean, I recommend a lot of memorization. In fact, what I'd like to assign is everybody memorize the entirety of the Bible. But I do like to recommend from time to time verses. And this next verse, verse 19, is a verse that I would recommend us all memorizing, committing it to memory, quoting it often one to another. The Lord God is my strength, and he will make my feet like hinds' feet, and he will make me to walk upon my high places. What high places? Where God is going to lift us up. Because this is describing how awesome God is. And this is a phrase, this is a statement, I think it would be good, like I said, for us all to memorize, quote it often one to another. Here in this chapter 3, I'd like to give a breakdown of lessons just from this chapter 3. They're powerful, and I can back it up with a lot, you know, with all of the verses and all of that, but I'm simply going to give a point. Lesson number 1 is in verse 1, start with prayer. If we find ourselves in situations, begin it with prayer. That's what Habakkuk did. You know, this is what we need to do. Instead of demanding answers from God or trying to tell God how he should do things, Habakkuk is now recognizing God's sovereignty, that God is in charge and who he is. And he talks about prayer. There's points of prayer here that I get out of this on this first one, start with prayer. And I get this out of this book. The first point about prayer is prayer takes our focus off of our circumstances and puts our eyes on God. Woe is me, woe is me, woe in me. Or, God, you're so awesome, you're wonderful, you're great. You know, which one's better? Well, that's what prayer is to do. And the second thing about prayer, under starting with prayer here, is that prayer may not change the circumstances, but it will change our perspective. Lesson number 2. This would be chapter 3, verse 2 and 16. Surrender and submit to God's authority. When we realize that God is all-knowing, when we realize that God is omnipotent, we will be willing to be instruments for his use, whatever it is that he has in mind. When we've really done this, it may not be easy, it may not be comfortable, but trials do help us to mature in our faith. That's what James 1 verses 2 and 3 tell us. Count it all joy when you fall into different trials, because it heals the peaceable work of patience. Lesson number 3 is chapter 3, verses 3 through 15. Remember God's greatness. Sometimes we just got to stop and think back about some of the awesome things that God has done in our lives individually or other people's lives and rejoice over that and remember that and think about how awesome God really is. Number 4, lesson number 4, Habakkuk chapter 3, verse 17 and 18. We need to reaffirm our faith in God, and we need to make some preparations for what is ahead. Habakkuk knew that Judah was in for some very hard times. And he knew that this was exactly what had been prophesied because God gave it to him. Yet he also determined to exalt and to rejoice in the greatness and the power of God. Just like we have to prepare for things, bad things coming. Like in this area, we know that we have to prepare, you know, for coming hurricanes. What Habakkuk is teaching us is that we have to prepare ourselves for coming trials, no matter what they may be. And the reason is because in the midst of a trial, we will not doubt and we will not lose faith if we are prepared or as we are prepared. Lesson number 5, Habakkuk 3 and verse 19. Take refuge and rest in the strength and the might of God. What I'd like to do is just in a 1, 2, 3, it's actually through 6. I would like to list out what I consider to be the major lessons out of the book, and I'm just going to list what the lessons are in a 1, 2, 3 order. Number 1, God may seem sometimes to be inactive, but he is involved. Number 2, God is holy. Number 3, God hears and answers prayers. Now, there's a lot more to that, but from this book, we see that. Number 4, God sometimes gives unexpected answers to our prayers. Number 5, God is just and good. And number 6, the righteous live by faith. I consider those to be major lessons out of this very short book. And brethren, because we live today, I believe, in a wicked society and a wicked world, the message of Habakkuk should be very comforting to us. When we understand, and we do need to understand, that prophecy is not just information to tell us what is going to happen in the future. Even though it is information to tell us what's going to happen in the future, that's not the only purpose. It is that. It is also to help us to see that God is in control. It is also to show us that we will see that God is going to preserve his people. Prophecy and this book of Habakkuk shows this very, very strongly, that it is bringing comfort now and hope for the future. The book of Habakkuk. And now the Aaronic blessing. Speaking to Aaron and to his sons, saying, on this wise you shall bless the children of Israel, saying unto them, the Lord bless you and keep you. The Lord make his face shine upon you and be gracious unto you. The Lord lift up his countenance upon you and give you peace. And they shall put my name upon the children of Israel, and I will bless them. So God bless you all. God bless you all.
For more information or answers to your Bible questions, please contact the Church of the Sovereign God. Our website is www.cotsg.org. That's www.cotsg.org. Or you may write to us at Post Office Box 89111, That's Post Office Box 89111, Tampa, Florida 33689.